The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the February 1st, 2024 online edition of the New Yorker magazine. Can slowing down save the planet? In a best-selling manifesto, the Marxist philosopher Kōhai Saito calls us to reject the logic of economic growth and embrace a different kind of plenty, by E. Tammy Kim. There are things you see walking through the big cities of South Korea that remind you of the recent but worlds-apart past. Vendors of live cuttlefish and quilted hemp linens in the traditional market. An elderly woman on the sidewalk selling small, homegrown quantities of millet and barley. Their customers are few. Everyone shops at malls and supermarkets now. I write from Cheonan, where my dad grew up, but the city of his youth has just a few square kilometers and a name in common with this one, a metropolis of nearly 700,000. There are undeniably good things about the new Cheonan. People are not starving. There are cars and extensive public transit. Who, though, is patronizing all these seafood restaurants and takeout cafes, indoor golf ranges, dermatology clinics, boutiques, and luxury department stores? So much neon and noise, plastic and profligacy. Is this what growth looks like? South Korea, one of the Asian tigers, is a star of developmental economics. The nation was, as recently as my own childhood, considered a third world country that first world countries relied on for labor and raw materials. Now it's a global leader in tech and pop culture and a regional metropole that draws workers from Africa and the rest of Asia. It also offshores toxic waste and employs thousands of people in factories abroad, including the United States. In a short time, the average South Korean's lifestyle has become indistinguishable from that of the average North American. What the researchers Ulrich Brand and Marcus Wissen call the imperial mode of living. The phrase is apt in the case of South Korea, whose industrial mentor was also its colonizer, Japan. In the East, Japan was the forerunner of Western industrialization, but many Japanese now want less of that and more out of life. The 2008 financial crisis made Marxism trendy there. The 2011 disaster at a nuclear plant in Fukushima led to mass introspection over energy use and food supply chains. The imperial mode of living and advanced capitalist monoculture is no longer viable. Human growth itself is what is destroying the very basis of what humans need to thrive, Kōhai Saito writes in his new book, Slow Down, The Degrowth Manifesto, translated by Brian Bergstrom, and first published in Japanese in 2020 as Capital in the Anthropocene. Saito has made a career of teasing out an eco-theory from the late unpublished writings of Karl Marx. He earned his doctorate at Humboldt University in Berlin and now teaches philosophy at the University of Tokyo. His first book was an English version of his dissertation titled Karl Marx's Eco-Socialism, published in 2017, which tracked Marx's study of the physical world and communal agricultural practices. Saito is fluent in Japanese, German, and English. In a second academic book, Marx in the Anthropocene, 2022, Saito drew on an expanded repertoire of Marx's unpublished notebooks to argue for a theory of, quote, degrowth communism, end quote. He gained a following not only in philosophical circles, but among a Japanese public facing the contradictions of tsunamis, billionaires, and same-day shipping. Slow Down has sold more than 500,000 copies in Japan and launched Saito into a rare academic celebrity. He appears regularly on Japanese television and aspires to the public intellectual status of Thomas Piketty, the French economist who had a surprise hit in his 2013 doorstop, Capital in the 21st Century. The key insight or provocation of slowdown is to give the lie to we can have it all green capitalism. Saito highlights the Netherlands fallacy, named for that country's illusory attainment of both high living standards and low levels of pollution, a reality achieved by displacing externalities. It's foolish to believe that the global north has solved its environmental problems simply through technological advancements and economic growth, Saito writes. What the North actually did was offload the negative byproducts of economic development, resource extraction, waste disposal, and the like, onto the global South. If we're serious about surviving our planetary crisis, Saito argues, then we must abandon capitalism with its insatiable appetites. We must reject the ever-upward logic of gross domestic product, or GDP, a combination of government spending, imports and exports, investments, and personal consumption. We will not be saved by a green economy of electric cars or geoengineered skies. Slowing down to a carbon footprint on the level of Europe and the U.S. in the 1970s would mean less work and less clutter, he writes. Our kids may not make it otherwise. The Japanese version of Slowdown features a headshot of Saito on the cover, looking quizzical in a gray sweatshirt. Behind him is a frightening future image of the Earth as seen from space, fire-red continents and pitch-black oceans. The book is identifiable as a shinsho, new book, a pocket paperback designed to explain difficult topics to a general audience. At times, it reads like the transcript of a lecture or debate, mired in signposting and repetition. The title, Slow Down, is a command. The manifesto of the subtitle underscores the book's crusading tone. It begins with a declamatory overture, Ecology is the opiate of the masses, followed by several chapters of elaboration. Counterarguments are tackled and disposed of. Examples of degrowth are plucked from Quito and Barcelona. In Saito's heterodox reading, there are two Marxes, only one of whom is correct. The first and better known Marx of the Communist Manifesto and Capital, Volume 1, focused on growth. He believed that capitalism, despite its exploitative tendencies, would bring about innovations through competition that would raise productivity, Saito explains. The first Marx inspired socialists to commit to industry on the logic that, quote, a rise in productivity would prepare the conditions for everyone in the future society to enjoy a rich, free lifestyle, end quote. Marxists in Europe felt entitled to become rich and free by stripping their far-off colonies, which was why Edward Said described Marxism as Orientalist. Though early Marx wrote perceptibly of the toll of capitalism on some human laborers, he neglected the harm involved in extracting coal and minerals and the damage done to trees, air, and water. But in Marx's later years, Saito writes, something changed. Between Capital Volume 1 and his death, Marx was engaged the entire time in an intense study of the natural sciences. The year 1868 was the turning point. Marx became ravenous for research on nature and communal forms of organization. He read Justus von Liebig, who described single-crop, quick-till farming as a robbery system, robbery of the soil. Marx learned about Mirs, agricultural communes in Russia, and believed that they could be developed into socialism without passing through capitalism. He also read about cyclical, steady-state economies among indigenous peoples in the Americas, India, and Algeria, and apparently snapped out of his Eurocentrism, Marx ends up asserting that it's precisely the steady state of the commune's economy that allows it not only to resist colonial domination, but also to hold within it the possibility of toppling the power of capitalism and achieving communism. Saito writes, "There is clearly a huge shift here. The second Marx recognizes capitalism's limits and nature's finitude." That a clunky shinsho about Marx's late writings would become a bestseller is a sign of our hot, grim times. But there is much in the particulars of Japanese experience that makes Saito's argument locally resonant. In the 1980s, Japan's economy was expanding, its GDP seemingly poised to shoot beyond that of the United States. But in 1995, Japan's bubble economy crashed and never recovered its earlier fantastical rates of increase. The GDP, that pesky index, settled into a modest zigzag. Economists called the ensuing years the lost decade and then the lost decades. Starting in 2012, Shinzo Abe, the country's longest-serving prime minister, paired promises of deregulatory growth, Abenomics, with aggressive nationalism. As a result of his special economic zones and tax cuts, or just pure chance, the GDP had a couple of strong years and then dropped off again. Still, Japan remains the world's third largest economy. For politicians, anything short of constant growth is an affliction. But, as Saito observes, traditional indicators such as GDP fail to accurately measure well-being. Life, for many Japanese and others in the global north, is too busy, materially excessive, and ecologically untenable. We would all be happier, he argues, by cutting back on work and consumption and devoting more hours to leisure, family, and sleep. No sincere reader of a degrowth manifesto believes that neoliberal expansion is the right policy for our times. Yet, Saito also wants to dismantle the seemingly virtuous model of green growth. Slow Down attacks its public-facing platform, the Green New Deal, which Saito sees as unable to take on climate change. He means not only the Green New Deal as conceived by progressive Democrats in the U.S., but also a general type of policy. The United Nations Sustainable Development Goals is another example. Green New Deals are in vogue among many liberal and left formations around the world and tend to be built of similar stuff. Money for climate tech and jobs in new energy, solar panels, wind turbines, public transit, and electric cars and school buses. These platforms promise to enlist economic growth in service of the planet, decoupling increased GDP from increased fossil fuel use. Rather than use less energy, Green New Dealers propose to replace coal and natural gas with renewables. Saito argues that it's impossible to prevent lethal warming without more radical change. Even if every country abided by the Paris Agreement, he writes, global temperatures may still result in catastrophic damage, especially in the global south. The only way out is to abandon the goal of economic growth altogether. Saito's communist alternative focuses on reordering labor. Less expansion would mean less regimented work. We could shorten our hours and try other kinds of jobs, elder care and child care, for instance, to fit society's needs. Ownership would be flattened. No more seasteading CEOs or private jets, but rather in their place, more co-ops and localized forms of exchange. GDP would be discarded as a measure of happiness. Saito is not the first theorist to propose degrowth as a solution to ecological scarcity. The New Left intellectual Andre Gortz first used the term in 1972 in a debate over a report by the Club of Rome, which called for zero growth amid anxiety over pollution and natural resources. More recently, the economist Tim Jackson and the anthropologist Jason Hickel have considered post-capitalist degrowth. The economist Ying Chen has explored the concept's application to the global South to guard against what Luis Inácio Lula da Silva condemns as green neocolonialism. Alas, none of this is politically attractive. As Matt Huber, a geography professor at Syracuse University and an advocate for the U.S. Green New Deal, has written, in a capitalist system defined by deprivation, who will support a program centering reduction? My colleagues, John Cassidy and Bill McKibben, have similarly observed that degrowth lacks the soothing pragmatism of green growth on its face, and by the sound of it, degrowth is subtractive, which seems bad. The imperial mode of living has wired us to associate smaller numbers and negative slopes with decay. But some aspects of degrowth are easier to imagine than others. During the worst of the pandemic, many people in the U.S. and other wealthy nations received something of a universal basic income. Municipal pilot programs were already in place. Care work was subsidized in the form of a generous child tax credit. Unemployment insurance was extended to all kinds of workers, and eviction moratoriums prevented mass homelessness. These policies were hugely popular. Less popular is the plea to radically change our day-to-day behavior. Degrowth is often illustrated in terms of individual consumer action, which green growthers are like to seize upon. Wearing a sweater indoors, Jimmy Carter style, or refusing to order cheap stuff on Amazon is not enough to save the planet, they say, rightly, but with a hint of caricature. Saito defends the household mandate to reduce, while pointing to a different kind of plenty. Unshackled from the arbitrary measurement of GDP, we could do more of what we want and put less strain on the planet in the process. At a social level, Saito would have us eliminate entire sectors, including advertising and packaging, that, quote, stimulates people's desires for things they don't need, end quote. Here he borrows David Graeber's notion of BS jobs. Saito looks, as Marx did, to small prefigurative formations, such as urban farms in Detroit and worker cooperatives in Spain. Another example comes from France, which hosted citizens' assemblies in 2019 to help form, quote, policies meant to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, end quote. Saito is careful to emphasize participatory democracy. He doesn't want degrowth communism to get mixed up with the bloody authoritarianism of so-called actually existing socialism. In place of a command economy, he puts forth a model based on local experimentation, an appealing vision, though difficult to scale. Here's my interpretation of Saito, the theorist in practice. Live in a small apartment rather than a big drafty house. Take the bus. Don't buy a car. Fly rarely. Stop ordering random stuff online, what Saito calls fundamentally useless things. Work less. In the process, get to know your neighbors and get some exercise, too. Multiply these actions by block and city, then notch them up to the levels of industry and state. Tax the rich. Provide a basic income to all. Steer capital toward home care and nursing homes, not arms manufacturing. Give subsidies and water to local farms, not big ag. Make neighborhoods dense and walkable and dependent on public transit. Destroy the GDP and the World Trade Organization, which has stifled climate change action plans based on the argument that they violate free trade. Saito isn't a monk. He and his wife own a Toyota and rent a three-story house in Greater Tokyo. They have two small children. Consider the carbon. Like late life Marx, Saito has taken an interest in communal agriculture. Once a month, he works on a farm outside the city. As he told the New York Times last summer, he is hoping to buy a large plot of land to run as a collective, with benefits going to local residents. His time with a shovel hasn't changed the world, or even his own life, but it's a useful rehearsal of degrowth, a dip into a less harried, less avaricious existence. Next, from the personal history section of the January 29, 2024 issue of The New Yorker, How to Eat a Tire in a Year, Walking and Talking with My Friend Dawn, by David Sedaris. It was a midsummer afternoon, and my old friend Dawn and I were walking from an unair-conditioned Nepalese restaurant to our hotel in the dull, flat town of Montrose, Colorado. The sun seemed larger than usual and brighter. It felt as if we were under a boiler. The road we were on was 6 lanes wide, or maybe 8. There was no sidewalk, so we were pressed right up against the curb, being passed by flatulent motorcycles, their riders helmetless, and 18-wheel trucks that were equally loud, but at least generated a breeze. One of the many good things about Dawn is that she never complains about walking. Never says, "You told me it was only another few blocks an hour ago." Never moans that her feet are tired or so swollen that her shoes no longer fit. The farther the better. That's our motto. Our record is 43 miles in a single day, 91,000 steps according to our Fitbits. "Where did you do this?" people ask when I boast about it. It's a question that baffles me. If someone told me he'd eaten 75 corn dogs in one sitting, my response wouldn't be "where," but "why not 76 corn dogs? Why not 80? We always talk about breaking our record, going for 100,000 steps. But now I worry that we might be too old. How weird is that? I was 19 when we met in the front hall of our dormitory at Kent State, and Dawn was a year younger. We know each other's siblings, and before they all died, we knew each other's parents as well. Dawn's father was a jazz musician who fell to his death in a skydiving accident when he was 50. Her mother was a former flight attendant who doted on her two sons but constantly picked at her daughter's appearance. Though I'll never understand why. Dawn dresses like a Swiss person. That is to say, she looks at all times as if she is headed to the airport, where she will fly business class. Everything matches or is color-coordinated, usually in earth tones. When I tell people that her wedding dress was brown, she corrects me, saying, "Not brown, driftwood," which is brown. She makes all her own clothes, save for some socks and underwear, though she could likely turn those out as well. Of everyone I know, she'd fare best if forced to live in a secluded cabin or 15th century Europe. She just has that look about her. Wiry and no-nonsense. Doesn't own any makeup. Smells like a cardboard box. Dawn grows her hair out, then chops it off to donate it to cancer patients. What remains is natural straw-colored, not a touch of gray, and easy to imagine beneath a bonnet or a snood. She hasn't used an ATM since 1990 when the machine ate her card, and as for her phone, forget it. Can't make calls but can make yarn, paper, ink, and some kind of non-dairy ice cream that tastes like fallen leaves. Dawn travels with me quite often when I'm on tour. She likes working the line, writing people's names on post-it notes and sticking them to the title pages of the books to be signed. "Who was that woman?" someone will invariably ask, implying that Dawn had been strict or unfriendly. Once in Uruguay, I forced her to take a test that would determine whether she was autistic. I had had my suspicions, but became certain after we spent a Halloween together and I watched her hand miniature staplers and homemade granola bars to the trick-or-treaters who came to her door. Kids don't want crap like that, I told her as one after another stomped off into the dark. Sure they do, she said. I mean, it's the kind of stuff I'd want. Yes, well, you're strange. To my great surprise, Dawn turned out not to be autistic. What puts people off is most likely her body language. The way she crosses her arms over her chest, for example, makes her look impatient. Also, her voice can be kind of flat. Totally flat, actually, if she doesn't know you. What? She says when I point it out. I'm friendly. I'm always friendly. During the height of the pandemic, a woman spit on Dawn. We were in the grocery store, and I hadn't done anything to her, she told me. I guess she didn't like that I had a mask on. One of Dawn's lungs collapsed when she was in her late 50s, so she was super cautious about COVID, kept her face covered long after everyone else had returned to normal. We were in Chicago together at O'Hare Airport in the spring of 2022 when I told her she needed to take it off. But, she said, let it go, I told her. Everyone else has. I felt like a director coercing an actress to unhook her bra for a sex scene. Come on, I said. You can do this. Start by just lowering it to your chin. She took off her mask and then, of course, immediately got COVID. A bad case, too. All my fault, but she's never held it against me. 15 months later, walking along the busy highway in Montrose, Colorado, we came upon 3 18-wheelers parked on a dusty lot. The doors of one were open, and inside were stacks of new-smelling tires. If you had a year, do you think you could eat one of those? I asked, pausing to wipe the dirt and sweat off my forehead with a bandana I'd been carrying. If you had to, I mean. Dawn looked inside the truck. A tire? Sure, if it didn't kill me. First thing I'd do is cut it into 365 pieces and then divide each one of those into pill-sized portions I'd eat throughout the day. That was exactly what I would do. I wonder what percentage of people would put it off to the last minute, I said. Can you imagine? Time's almost up. You have a knife in one hand and a fork in the other and are staring down an untouched radial tire thinking, F-word. A convertible roared by and we could briefly hear the music the driver was playing. A song that neither of us would ever voluntarily listen to. That's what my brother would do. Put it off, I told her. Then there'd be people who'd wait until the last minute and beg you to help them. It's the ant and the grasshopper when you really think about it. And though I'm not proposing this, if you had to cull the population, I think this would be a pretty good way to do it. Those who eat their tire by the deadline stay. Those who put it off and make excuses die. Well, that seems fair, Dawn said, adding that kids could be given bicycle tires. Our hotel in Montrose was so close to the airport, we could hear car doors slamming as passengers were dropped off at the terminal. Love you. Call us when you get there. It was a boxy chain place, meat locker cold and smelling of chlorine. But the young woman at the front desk, who had a streak of blue in her hair and wore enough makeup for 3 people her size, was efficient and welcoming. While checking in earlier that afternoon, we'd learned that she'd soon be taking the exam for her cosmetology license. Her study book was beside her when we came in after lunch. So we asked her to throw us a few test questions. Okay, she said and glanced down, squinting. How long does it take for a lost toenail to grow back? A year, Dawn said quickly, the way a contestant on a game show might, adding that she and I lose them all the time. The young woman took a half step back. Why? Because we walk so much, I told her. Every other month, I'll pull off a sock and feel something hard inside of it and realize you've lost a toenail, Dawn said. Sometimes I'll tape mine back on, she continued. It gives the little membrane underneath more protection as it grows. This was something I hadn't known. You tape your toenails back on? She looked down at her feet. Well, sure, but not all of them. The young woman's next question had to do with pH balance. Don got that answer right, too, though it may have been luck. I mean, it was multiple choice. We were in Montrose because we had to fly out very early the next morning, and so it seemed smarter to stay near the airport than in Telluride, where my reading would take place. Because I never got my license, and Don is admittedly a hopelessly bad driver, a man named Kevin had been hired to chauffeur us. He was 60, I guessed, and had graying hair gathered into a foot-long ponytail. When Kevin was young, he and his brothers would set traps and catch muskrats and beavers, mountain lions as well. Then we'd skin them out and sell the pelts for clothes and school supplies, he told us. Dawn, sitting beside me in the back seat, mending a shirt that I had worn, adjusting her glasses. Killing mountain lions? I don't like that one bit. I didn't like it either, but what do I know of life in the West? Growing up poor on the back of a horse? Well, then too, I'm just not confrontational. If someone told me he kept a dozen teenage girls locked in his basement as sex slaves, I'd likely ask, does it cost a lot to feed them? Not Dawn, though. The other night we were in Beaver Creek, I said to Kevin, hoping to change the subject. Have you been? They have a store there that sells wine and spirits and is called Beaver Liquors. No joke. As we left, we came upon a mean-looking town where, we were told, True Grit had been filmed. The hills surrounding it were scrub-covered and severe, crawling with snakes, I suspected. A sign in front of a church read, "It's not hot as hell." A bit further along, the land was greener, and Kevin pointed out Ralph Lauren's nearly 17,000-acre double RL ranch. Then he showed us a spot where, a few nights earlier, he'd come upon a bear and her cub crossing the road. They was taking their sweet time, too, he said. I stopped right yonder and waited for them to reach the other side. The land changed again an hour or so later as we neared Telluride. Now there were steep mountains with red cliffs visible through the aspens. Pronghorns get up there, then kick damn rocks down on you, Kevin said. I'd been on the fence about him, but now felt certain that, given a year, he would have not only eaten his tire, but helped someone else eat theirs, too. Because of its film festival, I thought Telluride might be good-sized, but in fact, it's dinky. Only 2,500 year-round residents. We had arrived early and had an hour to wander about before returning for sound check. Know someone for as long as I've known Dawn, and you figure you've got pretty much everything covered, at least in your past. So it surprised me during our walk to learn that when she was 7, she befriended a man of 26 who lived not far from her family in Marion, Ohio. I don't remember where we met. He was single, and I'd go to his house after school. Maybe we'd play board games or go on bike rides, depending on the weather. He was a lot of fun. We had discovered Telluride's outdoor pool and were looking at the swimmers through a chain-link fence. What did your parents think? I asked. For a long time, they didn't know, Dawn said. Then my dad found out. And after the two of them finally met, he came to me saying, "You didn't mention that your friend Howard is deaf." I was like, "Really? I just thought he was quiet." Quiet is letting the other person do most of the talking, I told her. Deaf is letting them do all of it. That aside, I love that no one made a big stink about it. Can you imagine that happening now? The man would be arrested along with the parents. Everyone would go directly to jail except for the kid who'd be in mandatory counseling for the rest of her life. It's startling to age and hear yourself talking like this. When I was young, a child could have a lonely adult bachelor as a friend. He had a lot of javelins in his house, Don recalled. It turned out he'd thrown them at the 64 Olympics. That makes it even better, I said, brushing some cottonwood fluff from the back of her dress, then leaving my hand to rest for a moment on her shoulder. When people ask how I know Dawn, I sometimes say, she was my girlfriend my second year of college. I always worry, though, that it makes her look dumb, especially if I'm at the theater after a reading and am wearing a sports coat that, for all intents and purposes, is a gown. She was my girlfriend, though, held my hand as someone in our dorm basement pierced my ear, wrapped her arms around my waist as we sledded down the campus's one decent hill, stayed up nights to help me with sculpture projects. Everyone knew us as a couple. We were in love. Back at Kent State, loving Dawn meant hating myself for being gay, for being too cowardly to admit it, and ultimately for hurting her the way I did. I will forever be grateful that she forgave me and that we can be in love again. How's your little wife? Hugh will ask after she and I have spent time together. Does Dawn's husband, Matt, behave this way? I often wonder. The thing is that she and I knew each other first, before Hugh and Matt, before Reagan and AIDS, before computers and Fox News and Run DMC. My feelings toward her are proprietary. Though currently on loan to her husband and stepchildren in the city of Red Wing, Minnesota, Dawn is mine. And although we've never discussed it, I'm pretty sure I'm hers as well. I know because I can feel it. When we're traveling and when we're apart, in high-altitude Telluride and sea-level Singapore, in Japan and the United Arab Emirates, in Argentina and Iowa, and all the places we go just so we can walk our toenails off and be together. Next, from the February 1st, 2024 online edition of The New Yorker, the Senate's false hope of a grand bargain meets its Trumpy demise. Whether folly, hubris, or denial, it was always going to end this way. By Susan B. Glasser. The carnival of stupidity that is a Donald Trump-led Republican Party remains the most distracting show on earth. Last week, after a jury found Trump guilty of repeatedly defaming the writer E. Jean Carroll, who has credibly accused the former president of sexual assault, the news was dominated by the $83 million penalty that Trump will now have to pay because of his big mouth. This week, Trump's GOP has been hyperventilating over the nation's most celebrated pop star, Taylor Swift, promoting elaborate conspiracy theories about the liberal-leaning musician and her Super Bowl-bound boyfriend, the Kansas City Chiefs tight end Travis Kelce. Trump, naturally, relished the fight, reportedly insisting that he is more popular and has more committed fans than Swift, who endorsed Joe Biden in 2020, and whose prospective support for Biden, again, seems to have sent the Trumpier corners of the internet into a frenzy. Even the Wall Street Journal was appalled. Whether it's lunacy or it's theater, the paper's conservative editorial board wrote of the Taylor Swift psyop, it reinforced one of the signal problems for the country in 2024. Paranoia on the right makes the Republican Party and its kooky demagogue seem, frankly, weird. If only weird were the sum of it. The problem, as ever with Trump, is that the performative foolishness serves only to divert attention from the real and serious consequences of the Republican Party's decision to get behind the defeated ex-president for another go at the White House. It's hard to imagine a more concrete example of this 2024 dynamic than the debacle unfolding on Capitol Hill, where Trump has demanded that his party kill a major deal linking funding for the wars in Ukraine and Israel with changes in immigration policy, designed to staunch the flow of asylum seekers at the U.S. southern border. The deal, still not yet formally unveiled, has been a couple of months in the making. Republicans were the ones who demanded it in the first place. Whatever the impetus of the current negotiations, whether folly, hubris, or just plain denial, it never seemed realistic to me that the two parties were going to engage with each other in good faith on immigration, arguably the most toxic subject in American politics in the Trump era, and somehow come up with a deal that would pass in an election year with Trump on the ballot. Both parties deserve some censure here. Have they not been paying attention these last 8 years? The opportunity to prove his continued dominance over the GOP by tanking any breakthrough was inevitably going to prove irresistible to Trump. He spoke at length about it to House Speaker Mike Johnson, Johnson acknowledges. And sure enough, Johnson, a non-entity who never would have become Speaker last fall had Trump not approved of him, did what Trump wanted, announcing in unequivocal terms that House Republicans would never go along with the Senate's bipartisan deal. Madness, he called it on Wednesday in his first floor speech as Speaker, though he insists it's absurd to say he was blowing up the deal just to please Trump. Tying the fate of Ukraine in its existential fight with Russia to a resolution of the near irresolvable politics of the American border seems a particularly cruel twist. For Trump, it's like a gift. Why wouldn't America's most noted admirer of the Russian President Vladimir Putin want to undercut Ukraine while, at the same time, sinking a package that might look like a real bipartisan win for Joe Biden? Trump wants an issue to run on, not a solution. And a potent issue it is. Recent surveys suggest that Biden is highly vulnerable to the charge that he's let the border problem fester, with voters in battleground states giving Trump a wide advantage on immigration. Never underestimate the appeal of personal vengeance to Trump as well. It hardly helps the case that this deal has been the top priority of his remaining nemesis in the Republican Party, the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. You know McConnell is in trouble when Democrats seem to almost be feeling sorry for him. On Wednesday night, at the annual Washington Press Club Foundation Congressional Dinner, the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer went out of his way to assure everyone that the current mess was not McConnell's fault. I've got 99 problems, but Mitch ain't one, he joked, though it was unclear whether the audience fully appreciated the Jay-Z reference. McConnell, at 81 and visibly frail since an accident last year, is widely assumed to be on his way out of the Senate. He has long wanted a support for Ukraine to be a part of his legacy. For months, he has gone to the Senate floor to implore colleagues in his party to stick with the fight. Instead, more and more of them are sticking with Trump, which has led to some awkward moments for McConnell, who, at one point in recent days, seemed to abandon the deal that he himself had asked another Republican senator, James Lankford of Oklahoma, to negotiate. By Wednesday, McConnell offered a near admission of failure, suggesting that it may be time to cut loose aid for Ukraine and look for a separate vote to continue funding. At the same time, Trump was in Washington blasting away at Republican senators who still support the deal as making a terrible mistake. The spectacle of Trump making Senate Republicans squirm was like an unwanted flashback to his years in the White House, when each week reporters would shove microphones in front of unhappy-looking lawmakers as they came and went from the party's weekly luncheon, asking for a comment on the latest Trump outrage. On Wednesday, Lankford came out of another contentious party lunch and complained that he was having to meet one-on-one with fellow Republicans to combat misinformation. Abraham Lincoln said, "Don't believe everything you read on the Internet," he said. Lisa Murkowski, like Lankford and McConnell, is one of the few remaining holdouts among Senate Republicans who have not yet endorsed Trump for another term. She told reporters that her party was to blame for the mess. It was the Republicans, I will remind you, that told the Democrats months ago that if you want to try to get your Ukraine funding, you're going to have to take up the border issue, she said. This is what we asked for. Amid the recriminations on Wednesday, I happened to go up to Capitol Hill for a long scheduled conversation with Senator Angus King, a low-key former governor of Maine, who refuses to join either party, though he caucuses with Democrats. King chairs the Senate Armed Services Subcommittee that oversees America's nuclear forces and is a senior member of the Senate Intelligence Committee. He was as alarmed as I have ever seen him about the consequences of the whole mess. While Republicans fight among themselves, the Pentagon has already, as of January, run out of congressionally approved funds for its military assistance to Ukraine. In the now languishing bill, Biden has asked for an additional $60 billion to aid the country. Many in Washington now expect that, even if a vote on funds for Ukraine eventually happens, Republicans will insist on billions of dollars less for non-military assistance as the price for their votes. But even that may not happen, and in the meantime, the president's vow to support Ukraine as long as it takes looks to be another hollow promise that a superpower divided against itself cannot keep. I think this would be, if we don't do it, the most serious foreign policy mistake of our lifetimes, King told me. It will reverberate for 50 years. Like the rest of us, King was struggling to make sense of the abrupt pivot by Republicans who were for the border deal before they were against it. When I reminded him that at one time many Republicans, as well as most Democrats, said that they were in favor of giving legal status to the so-called Dreamers, hundreds of thousands of undocumented immigrants who had been brought to the U.S. as children and never lived anywhere else, he quoted the late comedian Mort Saul, "If you maintain a consistent political opinion in this country long enough, you'll eventually be tried for treason." Barack Obama was one of many presidents who thought that there might be a glimmer of hope for a broad bipartisan immigration deal, and he held out a solution for the Dreamers in search of it. But the deal never happened. Instead, Obama enacted a temporary executive fix, one that is still being fought over in the courts now, a decade later. As for the fate of the Dreamers, it says everything that they aren't even part of the current negotiations. The politics have moved on. As this latest grand bargain heads towards its increasingly likely demise, with Trump heckling from the sidelines, the rest of the world will once again be gawking at our dysfunction. My experience around here is it's all about timing, King told me. He recalled Shakespeare's Caesar. Quote, "There is a tide in the lives of men which, taken at the flood, leads on to victory," end quote. His conclusion, if they miss this chance to do something serious about the border, there's no telling when it would come again. My conclusion is even simpler. Republicans have chosen which tide to take. After Trump, the deluge. Next, from the February 12th and 19th, 2024 edition of The New Yorker, Joe Biden's weird perception problem. For the president and his campaign staff, the problem is tactical. How can he pull this off? There's no shortage of advice. By Benjamin Wallace Wells. Everything about Joe Biden's reelection effort tends to be pretty quiet And so it was, with a characteristic mutedness that the campaign greeted its best week in a long time. Much of the good news had to do with the economy, as his stock market broke records and prices have come under control. "The war on inflation is over. We won," Paul Krugman, the Nobel Economics laureate, had declared. Donald Trump has been attacking the economy's performance since his reluctant departure from office, and so when he tried to take credit for it last week, it seemed a good gauge of how much the wind is shifting. "This is the Trump stock market," he wrote on Truth Social, "because my polls against Biden are so good that investors are projecting that I will win, and that will drive the market up." Election campaigns are competitive enterprises, not just consumer sentiment thermometers. So the more important developments for Team Biden concern Trump himself, and maybe his comeuppance for other poorly thought-through things he's written on Truth Social. Just 3 days after he won the New Hampshire primary, a New York jury ordered him to pay $83 million for defaming E. Jean Carroll, whom he had previously been found liable for sexually abusing. Criminal trials await, and nearly a quarter of Trump's supporters say they won't vote for him if he is convicted. Reason number 50 million, Trump won't beat Biden. His PAC spent $50 million on legal fees, as the Nikki Haley campaign put it. Trump wasted his victory speech in New Hampshire with a sour rant about Haley, after which she dug in deeper. In his courtroom appearances and his efforts to persuade the anti-Trump holdouts and the GOP to give up the Haley dream, he now finds himself in environments where his demeanor works against him. So do his supporters, who last week declared war on Taylor Swift. Run the numbers. As the election year begins and life in this country looks to be getting less bleak, more studded with possibility, in 2022, the U.S. recovered all the jobs lost during the pandemic. In the years since, unemployment has stayed below 4%, and the economy is now performing more strongly than that of every other wealthy nation, including China. Gaps that had seemed permanently wide began to close. The post-pandemic recovery reversed about a quarter of the growth in wage inequality that had taken place in the previous four decades. And the wealth of Black and Hispanic families grew by 61% and 47%, respectively, between 2019 and 2022, significantly outpacing the 31% increase for white families. Major unprecedented bills became law: the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS and Science Act, committing the country to an expansive building program, much of it in beleaguered regions, designed to accelerate the green transition. The progress isn't all linear. We are producing an immense amount of gas and oil. But scan the country, and you will catch glimpses of what might be an extraordinary transformation. In South Dakota, of all places, 84% of in-state electricity is now generated by renewable resources. Poll Americans, though, and the dissatisfaction with the current regime is profound. A few polls have shown Biden ahead of Trump. Last week, Quinnipiac had him up 50% to 44% nationally. But many align with Bloomberg's latest, which shows that voters prefer Trump in every swing state and trust him to better handle the economy by a wide margin. Only 29% in the same survey say that the country is on the right track. How can this be? Theories abound. Even if inflation is in retreat, prices for gas, groceries, and rent are still much higher than they've been in recent memory. And so it may be for some time before people believe that the economy is as strong as the numbers indicate. The news has focused on the flood of migrants at the southern border and on wars in Ukraine and Gaza, which can suggest instability and unease. And some who think that the country is on the wrong track are liberals who see in Trump's continued strength and in the Supreme Court's reversal of reproductive rights strong evidence that America is still defined by its reactionary turn. The country has been rife with inequality for a long time, and many may doubt that general gains will do much for them. People have earned their cynicism. For Biden and his campaign staff, the problem is tactical. How can he pull this off? There is no shortage of advice. The easiest path might be to run as Democrats have done successfully in every election after 2016, against Trump's assault on democracy and social values, and against his movement's extremism on gender and abortion, which has given Biden's party a huge advantage among women. The strategist Simon Rosenberg advised keeping it simple. Democrats are going to save the country. Republicans are dangerous. He added, since Trump unveiled himself as MAGA in the 2017-2018 cycle, we just keep winning elections. We won the 2018 cycle. We won the 2020 cycle. We won in ways that people never thought we would in 2022. That is mostly true. The Democrats lost the House in 2022, and 2020 was a nail-biter. Joel Benenson, who helped steer both Barack Obama's and Hillary Clinton's presidential bids, recently suggested taking the opposite approach. He said, one thing Mr. Biden should stop talking about, Mr. Trump, adding that the charges Trump faces are by themselves cause for alarm among the general public. Elections are about the future rather than the past, he noted, and urged Biden to make this one a forward-looking choice built on a contrast of economic vision and values. Yet, a funny feature of this campaign is that, since both candidates are unpopular, Biden is hoping, as his aides have told reporters, to let Trump have center stage so that voters might be reminded how much they despise him. A seeming consequence, though, is that it has left Biden saying how essential this election is, but saying so quietly. On one level, the choice that Biden faces seems profound. Make this election about the nation's continuing progress under his administration or about the destructive potential of a second Trump term. But he probably needs to do both, a little bit about the future, a little bit about the past. This will require turning up the volume. We're out of time for today's New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and are print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.